Down south, they say it's the economy, stupid. Up here, we say it's the economy, eh? And this is Political Economy Radio, a progressive take on economic issues in Canada and beyond. My name is Michał Rozwodski, and welcome to the show. I've been visiting family in Poland for the past 2 weeks, so fittingly, this week's podcast deals with European matters. My first guest is Yanis Varoufakis, professor of economics at the University of Athens, and candidate for Syriza in this Sunday's Greek parliamentary elections. Elections in which Syriza, the main Greek left party, is poised to take the most votes and potentially form a parliamentary majority. Yanis spoke with me about Greece's economy on the eve of the elections and Syriza's economic program. My second guest is Jakub Dymek, Polish academic, journalist, and editor. Jakub is, among other things, a member of the editorial collective of Krytyka Polityczna, or Political Critique, the main Polish journal of the New Left in Poland, and also the Polish correspondent for the US-based Dissent magazine. Unlike its Greek counterpart, Poland's electoral left is currently at its lowest point since the post-communist transition. I spoke with Jakub to get a sense of this electoral decline, the situation of social movements, and prospects for the future of Poland's left. First, though, my conversation with Yanis Varoufakis.
So, Yanis, I know this is an enormous topic, but what is the current economic situation in Greece on the eve of the elections? Can you give us a kind of snapshot of what's the state right now?
Well, in brief, everyone owes to everyone, and no one can pay. The banks are bankrupt. They owe money to the state. They owe money to each other, to foreign banks. Citizens owe money to the banks and owe money to the state. The state owes money to everyone. So we have just, you know, we have a triple insolvency. We have a bankrupt state, bankrupt banks, and a bankrupt private sector. There are, of course, pockets, like everywhere, within society, of people who are really well off, who have money in banks in Switzerland, in the city of London, in Wall Street, in Frankfurt, including some money in the Greek banks. But the overall situation is that, you know, even though in the last year or so there's been a kind of small rebound, not in terms of incomes, but in terms of expenditure, the economy is quite clearly, you know, still in a downward spiral that is filling everyone's soul with negative expectations.
And it's interesting you mentioned that, the slight rebound. Because what I found interesting is that there seems to be a bit of a reversal maybe of 2012. So, you know, on the one hand, now some of the economic indicators, as you said, you know, in minimum ways, but, you know, maybe we can say that they've even improved. But on the other hand, the population in Greece, from what I gather, seems to be, you know, more immune to the kind of fear-mongering from both Greek and European elites against the left. What's changed? What's led to this sort of slight reversal or this different situation from 2012, where this time around Syriza actually has a chance of gaining a majority in parliament?
Well, two things mainly. Firstly, Syriza has matured over the last 2 years. There's no doubt about that. So it has inspired more confidence in the electorate. And secondly, perhaps even more significantly, now it is abundantly clear that the whole narrative of a Greek cover, if you remember a year ago or so, was just utterly bogus. It was a piece of propaganda, a bubble that burst. And Greeks are sick and tired. Look, I was in a taxi this morning, and the taxi driver said to me, he recognized me as a candidate, and he said to me, "Well, let me tell you this, sir," he said, "Greeks fall under two categories. There are those who are really scared of losing what little they've got left, and the rest who don't give a damn, they just want to vote in a way that states it for everyone to see outside of Greece that we're not interested in this vicious cycle anymore."
And so let's move to the future a little bit. As you mentioned, you're a candidate for Syriza. Let's say Syriza wins the elections with a majority. What would be the most important tasks facing a hypothetical finance minister in a Syriza government in, say, the first few months or year after a hypothetical win?
Three things. Firstly, to conduct a thorough tough negotiations with our European partners, with the IMF, with the European Central Bank, in order to revise radically the illogicality of our loan agreement with our creditors, with our official creditors. That's number, task number one is the renegotiation, to put it bluntly. Task number two is to address somehow the humanitarian crisis by spending a small amount, a relatively small amount of money, feeding the hungry, making sure that children don't have to work in candlelight at night doing their homework, and looking after the weakest and the most innocent victims of this crisis. That's the second task, the humanitarian crisis, in brief. And thirdly, to ensure from a fiscal point of view that the revenues of the state do not collapse as a result of some kind of strike by those who have the capacity to pay taxes.
How realistic is this? What kind of pressure, by this I mean the third point, what kind of pressure can you expect to be brought to bear, and what kind of means could be used by, like you say, those who have the capacity to try this, stop revenue and stop this program?
We are already in receipt of a number of threats from the oligarchs, who feel extremely uneasy about the prospect of us forming a government. We receive threats daily at the level of the leadership, at the level of us personally, even threats to our families. There is no doubt that the kleptocracy is going to fight tooth and nail against an incoming Syriza government, whose purpose it is to enact proper reforms, and by proper reforms I mean to smash this triangle of sin, as I call it, between the contractors, the state's contractors, the bankers, bankers who live off money given to them by the state and borrowed by the hapless taxpayer, and thirdly, the mass media, the systemic television, radio, and and newspaper networks, who are all bankrupt and who are being fed by, kept alive in a kind of zombified state by the zombified banks, who in turn take their money from the bailout loans. So this triangle of sin is out there to get us. And we're going to have to wage a war against them come Monday morning if we win this election.
What about the EU, and by this I mean both the political arms and the European Central Bank? What are the strictures imposed by the EU, and more generally, what can be done within these strictures? That is, are the rules so strict to tie the hands of any government? Like so many others have already said, too bad, we have to implement more austerity, but it's this piece of paper says it, but not the elites. Obviously, Syriza says they're not going to do this, but what is the space to actually get out of these strictures that have been used by, government after government across Europe to say, too bad, this piece of paper says we have to do this to our population?
On Monday morning, after we form a government, we are determined that we shall simply address our European partners and propose to them that we sit down around the table and hold a rational discussion about how the costs of the Greek program to the average European citizen can be minimized in such a way that the whole of Europe benefits and Greece gets a chance to breathe within it. We have confidence, which we effectively pluck out of a degree of optimism about democratic Europe, that our partners will not refuse us the opportunity to listen to rational ideas and proposals for the benefit of everyone in Europe.
What can the situation in Greece now do for Europe? What are its broader implications, especially for the economic policies that we've seen across Europe, not just in Greece, and especially at the European level, at the level of the European institutions?
Well, let me remind you that Greece was the canary in the mine. In 2010, we were the weakest link of the chain. Even if we didn't exist in the Eurozone, somebody else would have taken our place, because this was a systemic crisis that Europe steadfastly refused to deal as such. And the social cost throughout Europe of this denial has been enormous, and it is actually growing. So it doesn't really matter whether it's a Greek prime minister or an Irish prime minister or a French prime minister who simply stands up in a European Union Council meeting or a Europe Group meeting and says, no, we are not going to feed unsustainable debt with unsustainable debt on condition of austerity that reduces the income from which these debts will be repaid. And we need to have a rational discussion in Europe that deals with the problem that we constructed the Eurozone, a monetary union that was incapable of sustaining the financial crisis of 2008-2009, and our denial after that in 2010 onwards, which took the form of the Greek memorandum, the Greek bailout number one, which then became the template that was applied to all the other nation states in the Eurozone. That approach has failed demonstrably. And let's have a discussion right from the beginning, instead of insisting that we have had agreements over the last year that now need to be implemented. They cannot be implemented. They can't be implemented more than the Versailles Treaty was implementable after 1919.
You're still talking about agreements, though. At this point, does the future of Greece lie within or outside the euro and the eurozone?
We're determined that we have a place in Europe and that we are going to seek policies that are good for Europe as well as for Greece. We believe that the fragmentation of the Eurozone, the fragmentation of the European Union, whatever one might think about the history and the rationality of the design of the European Union and the Eurozone, regardless of those thoughts and criticisms, the fragmentation of what we now have created in Europe is going to be absolutely detrimental for every European nation and indeed for the global economy as a whole. Do not forget that the global economy has not really managed to climb out of the hole that the financial sector's implosion caused in 2008. Europe is one third of the global economy. It is stuttering, it is faltering, it is exporting deflation to the rest of the world. China is slowing down. The United States is doing what it can in order to remain in a kind of quasi-growth situation. And Europe is perfectly capable of inflicting major damage upon the global economy. We've done it before. Twice in the last 100 years, Europe has done a great deal of damage to the rest of the world. It is about time that we stop doing this. And Greece, on the 25th of January, this coming Sunday, presents a glimmer of hope that a conversation can begin. We're not going to dictate to the rest of Europe what needs to be done. All we can do is can open a small door from which the rest of our colleagues in Europe can pass into a conference room where we can have a decent conversation, the kind of conversation that we have refused to have so far.
Right. Yanis Varoufakis, thanks so much for taking the time in these last few days in the lead up, and best of luck to you on Sunday.
Thank you very much.
That was Yanis Varoufakis, Greek economist and Syriza candidate. Up next, my interview with Jakub Dymek of Krytyka Polityczna on the situation of Poland's left.
So hi, Jakub. Maybe you could start generally with the political situation in Poland. And I think one thing that I found interesting, and maybe listeners might not know, is that while other parts of the European periphery have recently seen a rebirth of left politics, for example, Greece, Spain, also even places like Slovenia, Poland's left is actually, I think, at one of its weakest points since the fall of communism. What is the current situation of the left in Poland, and what helps explain this relative weakness right now?
Well, honestly, it's one of the questions I hear most often with interviews like this one, and I have to say frankly that the parliamentary left in Poland is virtually non-existent to the extent that there is no left party to talk about if we span the realm of the parliament and the Sejm, which is Polish upper house. Yet it would be unfair to say that the left itself is absent from politics, because you see plenty of new initiatives and groups, NGOs and unions that try to shape the political scene. But when it comes to which of those initiatives gain traction, it's sad to observe that in the end it all comes to the failure of the party politics to actually engage in any sort of left agenda. This is of course because the main left party that stayed on the scene after 1989, it was post-communist left alliance, the SLD, which during its two periods at the head of the government didn't really manage to achieve any of the leftist goals it had, they professed to had, and the more it decreased in any real chance of changing politics itself, the more it changed its agenda to fit more fittingly into neoliberal and centrist and post-political landscape of post-crisis Europe. So as you've said in your question, there is no really any comparison between Poland and Greece, and even if it's Slavic counterpart in Slovenia. And the reason for that is the lack of engagement of the party system. That's not any new thing in itself, but rather a continuum of disappearance of the left from 1989 onwards.
Right, and maybe I could track back quickly to what you mentioned about the SLD, the main post-communist left mm-hmm. party. And as you said, you know, it was in power, I think, for the longest period during the early 2000s, and it actually implemented, you know, a fairly neoliberal program, and in some ways continued and even expanded the reforms of the 1990s. What did this Polish version of neoliberalism look like? You know, what was there anything specific about it? And was this complicity, as you said, of the left in sort of building neoliberalism explain this gap sort of between, you know, as you said, the social movements and electoral politics on the left side of the spectrum?
First thing to say is that Polish left had this tragic historical irony of having a chance to be reborn in a democratic shape after 1989, and yet it was the very same time where the left in Europe was at its highest, at its historical lowest point. If you remember the New Labour strategies and the New Labour movement in Europe and the politics of Blairism in the UK, you can realise how actually pro-market and neoliberal that shape of the left was at the time.
Right, exactly.
And it's then when Polish left could actually think of something new, and this new form was the New Labour. So it's really ironic and tragic in that sense. And coming back to your question about the specific Polish shape of neoliberalism, I would say that it's not only the montage of the social state, which wasn't very strong in the first place in the 1990s, but it's also complicity towards the traditional institutions like the church and nuclear family that makes it for neoliberal reforms even easier to act against the state mandated social policies, because when it comes to your private life and your family life, there is always some conservative agenda that would say, well, you do not need the state anymore, because you can turn to your family, turn to your traditional familial values, you can delegate your children and care for elderly and children to the women, because it's their traditional role. If you cannot find a job, you can rely on your parents, because it's a traditional form of family, etc., etc. So this is very idiosyncratic when it comes to neoliberalism implemented in post-Soviet traditional societies that haven't fully emerged from that phase.
Right, and what's happened since this period? How has the Polish left evolved, and has there been sort of a reaction to what this post-communist tendency did? Is the rebuilding happening sort of in a different, even if it's not happening electorally, is there still, you know, in the social movements a response to what had happened, and this sort of, as you're saying, this complicity with traditional values and all the rest of this?
Of course there is, and I would name a few initiatives first, and that's the one I'm part of, it's Critica Politična, an intellectual, theoretical and academic sort of movement trying to rebuild this public engagement on the leftist intelligentsia that was so that was a brand of Eastern Europe's Marxism throughout the 20th century. And on the other hand, new unions acting very bravely and engaging many different sectors of the labor, from shopping malls to precarious call center jobs through universities and academias. So that's the second leg of the movement. And not to mention brave anti-TTAP, the Transatlantic Trade Partnership with the US, or anti-ACTA, the other very dangerous US-EU partnership that emerged in Poland during the last few years. Green Party as well, that's been very active. And yet all of those movements combined together cannot properly enter the party system that's been notoriously closed and corrupted for years. Yet, if there is something that's a notable achievement of these movements, is changing the balance of the party politics itself, making them, and by them I mean parties and leading politicians, less eager to push neoliberal agenda and reforms without ever noticing the masses that would be inadvertently hurt by those reforms, which we've seen during the mining crisis of recent weeks, and before that, the so-called junk contract crisis that's been a permanent fixture of Polish capitalism, that you cannot find stable employment, even if it's sometimes good paying employment, it's never stable and with social benefits. So this crisis has shown that even there is virtually no left in the system, there is still plenty of left outside the system that's playing the role of checks and balances against the right in power.
Maybe we can move for a second to the economy too, and the role. I think the other thing that's fairly unique in Poland is that this is a country that actually didn't really experience, at least in the official statistics, the crisis of 2002, 2008 as much. You know, the rest of Europe has fallen into really a deep stagnation, and Poland's sort of kept on growing. How has this degree of economic dynamism, even if it's been unevenly spread, helped elites, and how has it affected the political scene?
You mean the crisis or the post-crisis policies?
The post-crisis policies, but the way that Poland's been seen as a sort of, you know, odd one out in Europe, and the one that sort of managed to somehow make it through the crisis rather than fall into, you know,
it's a very good question, because you have to notice that Poland didn't experience this austerity politics at all, which is funny and which is really an exception in the European scene, that you cannot speak of austerity politics as you have witnessed them in Greece, Portugal, Spain, and so on. And this is attributed to a few things, and one of them is that we had pretty traditional, pretty conservative banking system before the crisis, and it wasn't entangled in those speculative operations so much that it wouldn't be hurt. So this is the upside of having a traditional banking system that's still regulated by the country, by the state, right? But the other less optimistic reason, I mean less optimistic explanation for that, we hadn't seen the austerity measures applied and the crisis taking full effect, is that we've already had, as we call it, expelled our jobless people to the UK, right? Because they moved to the UK or Germany to find jobs there. And we closed, or we enclosed, the whole young generation in the schooling system. So we have two huge, large groups that are not actually part of the market economy anymore in order to reduce unemployment. So the registered unemployment is very, very low. The GDP grows steadily, et cetera, et cetera. So you don't see the effects of the crisis in the economic statistics, that's for sure. But you do see them, and you do see them very gravely when it comes to demographics, because there is whole young generation absent from the country, like literally absent from the country because it left the UK.
Right, yeah, that, and, I mean, it was millions of people, right?
Yeah, exactly. Point. It's estimated that there's roughly 3 million of Polish immigrants throughout the world, and nearly one quarter of them in the UK itself. It's a lot of people, right? It's as much as Czech Republic or Slovenia have in total. And you see grave effects of that in demographics, because rate of childbirth in Poland is lowest since, I believe, 1960s. The demographics looks very bad, and its effects on the public social security system and pension system, which has been funded from taxpayers' money, is actually on the brink of the crisis. So you cannot say that the crisis of 2008 didn't have an effect. To be more precise, you have to say that it had its invisible effects in the macroeconomic statistics, and it had a very visible effect in the demographics and social structure.
Right. And maybe I just have a minute or two to close. Maybe we can return very quickly just to the, given this context, return to the prospects of the left in Poland.
Yeah.
You mentioned the initiatives that are there. You mentioned this sort of electoral chasm. What are the prospects going forward? Are there shoots of hope, if we can speak to them? And what's happening to rebuild the Polish left, and how are the economic conditions playing into this?
At this point, you can certainly say that there is no hope in the parliamentary system, because the leading post-communist pseudo-leftist party had compromised any of the chances for winning presidency and or parliamentary elections by having chosen a former model and actress as the leading candidates, with actually the most rightist agenda of all the candidates so far. So it's a no-brainer on their side. And yet you have to say and admit that there is plenty of non-partisan coalition talks being done right now. And if there is one popular list on the left for the parliamentary elections of 2015, we can be certain that it won't win them the election, we know that, but it would possibly and positively could engage them within the system and try to change it from the inside as of 2015 and onwards. And that's our hope for now.
Jakub Dymek, thanks so much for this chat.
Thank you.
That was Polish journalist Jakub Dymek. That's all for this week. Talk to you in 2 weeks. Until then.